Let me start thanking Rob and also Gravitational Group for the invitation. I understood that Gravitational Group initiated this invitation. I just tried to kind of adapt the usual talk for Quantum Foundation community also to people who are more on gravitational side. I'm going to talk about Bell's theorem for temporal order. And this work has been done together with Magdalena Zich, Fabio Costa, and Igor Pikovsky. All three of them were my PhD students. Now they are postdoc positions, Magdalena and Fabio at University of Queensland, and Igor at Harvard. As the title suggests, I'm going to talk about Bell's theorem, and this time for temporal order. In all our broadly accepted theories, including quantum field theory and curved space-time, the order between events is assumed to be predefined. Of course, in quantum gravity, we want to go beyond that, but in the theories that assume fixed background, this causal order is also assumed to be predefined. Now, this is an attempt to actually find the situations in which we can have a no-go theorem for, as you will see, locally predefined temporal order, and I will be more specific later on. Here is the content of my talk. First, I will just have a very broad introduction, just one slide about what Bell's theorem is about and why we think it's important. And then I will go into a notion of event that I will use for the purposes of this talk and of the temporal order. I will then introduce a basic element that will lead us to the violation of Bell's inequalities for temporal order. This is a gravitational quantum switch. And then I will start with describing the Bell's theorem, first listing the assumptions behind the theorem. And I will do this within the framework of so-called generalized probabilistic theories. So I want to show that in a very general framework, under certain assumptions, the temporal order will be predefined. And then with the use of gravitational quantum switch, I will show a quantum violation of Bell's inequalities. And finally, I want to comment on the results, what they really mean, and look for maybe some future open questions. So let me start with the Bell's theorem. In the situation of Bell's inequalities, we usually have two separated parties, Alice and Bob. They are space-like separated, and they reside in their laboratories. And we usually distinguish between two random variables in these laboratories, one of them being the measurement setting. It's a choice made by an observer, usually. That's an independent random variable. And then there is an outcome, which I denote here A for Alice and B by Bob. And then in the so-called locally causal theories, and I use here the terminology as in original Bell's work, the locally causal theory predicts that all correlations between these two measurements are established via some kind of a shared, let's say, hidden variable lambda shared in the common past of the two observers. And then the probabilities can always be decomposed in the way it's here, where rho lambda is just a probability distribution. And then we have some response of the Alice measurement device that depends only on her choice and some response on Bob's measurement device that depends on his choice, Y. Now, the Bell's theorem is a statement that there are quantum correlations, there are probabilities that we can observe and are represented in quantum mechanics that are not of this form. So then we can say quantum physics really violates Bell's local causality, and that has been confirmed even in a loophole-free manner in recent experiments. So why do we think it's a very important message of Bell's theorem? Because that's the way how we can demonstrate non-classicality in a theory-independent way. So you see that here we have probabilities responses. I didn't tell you anything about how these measurement devices function, what is the system that they share, what the kind of operations in which theory these operations are performed. So you don't know anything about internal structure and mechanism and physics behind measurement devices, and yet you can state something very importantly, namely that quantum mechanics is in disagreement with this local causality. So it's a theory-independent tool to demonstrate non-classicality, and it's not an accident that experimentalists usually use this as a proof that they even have entanglement in laboratories. And secondly, what I want to say is that Bell's theorem has been confirmed for many degrees of freedom, spin, polarization, energy, momenta. But what we want to do right now is to apply it to temporal order. And this doesn't seem trivial because there is no observable for temporal order. You cannot just measure temporal order and then use the usual treatment of Bell's inequalities. Okay, so now I'm going into the notion of event. This notion of event will be an operational one, is maybe not the common also as we use in a general relativity, and you will see the difference later on. So what you here see is a laboratory. Then you have an observer, you have some measurement devices, there is some control of the measurement settings, there is a result, and also there is a watch. Now, event will be identified with some operation, which I call MA. This is, could be a unitary or it could be a measurement and re-preparation. So it will be a general operation. I didn't even specify in which theory I'm working, so it's still a theory-independent notion. And I will use this laboratory just as a label that includes reference frame information where this operation has been performed and when this operation has been performed. So I will have this watch to measure local time, but this is just an abstraction of the entire internal degree of freedoms of the laboratory that could, of course, evolve in time. And I pick up tau just to represent this entire internal degrees of freedom that could be dynamical. Now, in the practice, we don't need to have an observer. We don't need to have really watch. You don't have to have any, in standard sense, measurement device. But it's useful to think in this operational way. At the end of the day, it will be defined by operation and relative to all possible relative degrees of freedom that may be dynamical in this laboratory. Now, here is also the first attempt to define the classical causal order, and I will be more specific later on. Again, what I will say that the two operations are causally connected if there is a theory in which the meaning that one operation has been performed before the other one is represented by a composition of two operations. So here I have a composition such that MA is performed first and then MB. And what it would mean that there is maybe some state, not general, in general, not necessarily quantum state, it could be state from a more general framework, that enters Alice's laboratory and then goes out and enters Bob's laboratory. And this sequence will be understood as a temporal sequence and represented mathematically in this way. Now, this is again a theory-independent notion of definite causal order because I didn't specify, except for the notion of compositions, what this theory is. And it also has an operational meaning in a sense that one can even signal from one to another. So from the past to the future, there is a one-way signaling only from one laboratory to another, meaning that the first one is in a causal past of the second one.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sure.
Go back one slide. So here, are you just as happy to say an operation MA performed when another operation MT equals tau? Or is there something other than that you mean by the circle time?
You will see very soon why I need this. I will treat it through the entire talk tau as kind of a local coordinate system. It will be, at the end of the day, a proper time. It will be a classical degree of freedom. However, the results do not rely on this. And I can treat as any quantum system. That's why I'm talking about entire internal state of temporal reference frame. It could be also a quantum degree of freedom. The results do not rely on that, but it's easier if we keep it as a classical degree of freedom and as a kind of a reference point that when I apply operation MA and I look at the watch and I see that time instant tau, then I say this is one event. But the event will be defined operationally as this, as the same operation. And the other one I understand as a coordinate system. You can use the other coordinate system, and here it will be useful to take the local coordinate system. I mean temporal coordinate system. Okay, now I'm switching to something which is where the gravitational people are more familiar with and which I need to develop the gravitational quantum switch. And that's the property of the general relativity that allows to treat causal structure dynamically. What I mean with this, that you can dynamically influence the order between events by putting the mass distribution in the causal past of these events. And here I pick up two events, that's events A and B, that happens at the local time, well, 10 past 10, which is tau star, according to the local clock. And I assume that the two clocks are synchronized at the beginning and that the two events are space-like separated, just like at the picture. These are the world lines of the two laboratories. Now, in this case, we don't have any influence from one event to another just because they are space-like separated, and therefore they are not causally connected. However, I can change the setup slightly by bringing a mass, a large mass, closer to one laboratory as compared to another one, and this is, well, Earth, closer to Alice laboratory. And in that way, I will induce gravitational time dilation. And this gravitational time dilation is here illustrated by the intervals that are here longer between, well, minutes, let's say. So we have here gravitational time dilation as compared to the Bob time. And this can be the time dilation to such an extent that if I send a signal according to Bob at time 10 past 10, there is enough time for a light signal to travel from B to A and arrive at Alice's laboratory before her clock shows 10 past 10. So at the beginning, removing the mass, these two events will be space-like separated. But now putting the mass closer to Alice's laboratory, I can bring them, two events that are causally disconnected, into causally connected, and they become time-like separated. Now, how we can do that, and what are the conditions to achieve this? So here is how you actually compare the local times, as shown by Alice and Bob. G00 is the G00 component of the metric tensor. And this is the time as shown by Alice's clock compared to the time as shown by Bob's clock. It depends on this square root of the ratio of G00 metric, the tensor element, at the two measurement stations. Now, that's one element that we need to find out when something like this is possible. And the second element that I need is the how much time elapses for the photon to propagate from B to A. And this is given here in terms of the coordinate time, in terms of somebody who is far away, and depends not only on G00 tensor, but also on the spatial part of the metric tensor. Now, again, what I want to show is, well, that this is something possible, and this is the conditions to achieve this, and I explain each individual term in this condition. First, we already denoted by TC the coordinate time of photon propagation, but if I want to express this in a time as shown by Alice clock, then I have to multiply this with the square root of G00 tensor at the Alice laboratory. And then I have an event at B, which is measured by the B clock, it's tau star. And if I want to compute what this event is according to, at which time it is according to the Alice clock, I have to multiply with this ratio, and then I will get the event at B measured by Alice clock. Now, when I add up these two times, and I want this to be less than tau star, as shown by Alice clock, I achieve exactly what I announced before, namely that even an event that was sent by T star according to Bob clock, there is enough time that the signal comes on Alice's side and arrives at a time which is less than or equal than tau star according to the Alice clock. So in that way, the two events that were at tau star initially without the mass and were space-like separated become now time-like separated by bringing mass closer to one of the laboratories. Now, in that way, I achieved that B and A become causally connected. And in a certain sense, I open a channel for possible communication between B and A, meaning that I can have in this mass configuration K, where B is before A, I can have a state that enters Bob's laboratory. Bob can perform some measurement, or in our case, he will perform some unitary, send away to Alice, and then she can perform some unitary in that way, opening the channel from B to A. And I have a sequence of these two unitaries for this mass configuration. Now, what you see here is actually on the left-hand side is just the opposite situation from the one at the right-hand side, which we just discussed. Namely, in this case, I bring the mass closer to Bob laboratory. And of course, the roles of Alice and Bob are now interchanged. And that's the way how I can open the channel from Alice to Bob. Now, we see that causal structure depends on the distribution of matter or stress energy tensor of the matter degrees of freedom in the causal past of the events. So we have completely different causal orders. And the order between these two events is actually swapped in all possible reference frames, because the time-like separated events remain to be time-like separated in all possible reference frames. Now, the next what I want to do is to make a step and construct a quantum superposition of these two situations. And that's where we enter the realm of quantum gravity. Now, how I want to do is, this is to list few assumptions that do not rely on any details of a chosen quantum gravity model. And these three assumptions are rather innocent. And you will see soon what they are. But the idea is that whatever model you choose, in certain limits, they should reproduce these three assumptions. Of course, it's possible that the nature do not obey them. But for the purposes of this talk, we will assume they are correct. So what are these three assumptions? So I will first read them and then try to argue in favor of them. First assumption is that macroscopically distinguishable states of physical systems can be assigned orthogonal quantum states. The second assumption is that gravitational time dilation in a semi-classical limit reduces to that predicted by general relativity. And the final one is that quantum superposition principle holds regardless of the mass of the superposed systems. OK, so what's the meaning of the first one? Well, macroscopically distinguishable states of physical systems corresponds, in our case, to two possible configurations that we defined as KA before B or KB before A. They are macroscopically distinguishable. And the first assumption allows me to assign quantum states to these two configurations. And furthermore, these are quantum states that are approximately orthogonal to each other. So you can think about that, for the people who are more familiar with quantum optics, as kind of a coherent states. And whenever you pick up two coherent states that are more separated than the uncertainty assigned to any of them, you have states that are almost orthogonal. But still, you can think and that each individual coherent state have some uncertainty. So in certain quantum gravity model, these coherent states will certainly have some uncertainties. For example, in linearized quantum gravity, that will be the uncertainties related to different components of the metric tensor. But that's not what we are. We do not rely on that, and we will consider only situations in which the separation between these two coherent states is much larger than any possible uncertainty assigned to each of them, and therefore they are mutually orthogonal. And that's the case when they are really macroscopically distinguishable states. The second assumption tells you that if you have a semi-classical limit, so if you have a mass in one or the other configuration which follows a semi-classical world line, then the effects that this mass will produce are just like the effects that we know from the general relativity. And final assumption tells you that even the superposition of mass is allowed, and therefore also the superposition of two mass configurations that we write in that way. So, of course, in reality, it might be that some of these assumptions will break. They are very specific ideas in quantum foundation community why you should not introduce the superposition of masses, the microscopic superposition of masses. But any of these choices, to my opinion, are more radical than keeping those three assumptions. Therefore, they will maybe induce a new and more interesting physics, but here we take a more conservative approach. Now, if these three assumptions are met, then we can do something like that. We can have a kind of beam splitter for large masses. And if we have a reflected path and the mass ends closer to Bob's laboratory, we will open a chance from Alice to Bob. And if we go and transmit, if the mass is transmitted through the beam splitter, it ends closer to Alice's laboratory, and we open the chain from Bob to Alice. So at the end of the day, with this gravitational quantum switch in a sense that you can, depending on the mass configuration, have one or the other causal order, you can have a controlled unitaries. And this is a unitary if the two states are orthogonal. That's why we had this first assumption. So if you have one mass configuration, you have a control order of unitaries where you apply first Alice and Bob unitary on some system. A system could be, for example, polarization of a photon or some other internal degrees of freedom of the flying system. And if you have configuration Bob before Alice, the order of unitaries is just the opposite. Okay, so now we have an element that we use in order to violate Bell's inequalities for temporal order. The next that I want to introduce is something, again, more familiar to the quantum foundation community, and that's the general probabilistic theories. The aim is to have a larger framework, a huge class of theories, for which we will assume certain assumptions, in particular a definite temporal order. And then we will show that all these theories with these assumptions satisfy Bell's inequalities for temporal order. And then we will find a situation in nature for which quantum mechanics, together with the three assumptions in this quantum gravity realm, can violate these Bell's inequalities. And therefore, we get a Bell's theorem for temporal order. So here, I just introduce in two slides general probabilistic theories. I will not go into great detail. So the general probabilistic theories is a framework in which you can consider classical quantum, possibly also post-quantum theories, all theories in which you have a state space that is represented with certain set of fiducial measurements. that are measurements that completely describe your state, and you can assign probabilities for all possible future experiments knowing the state at certain time. So here, this is a classical bit represented by a line where the ends of this line is a classical zero and classical one, but you can also convex mixture these two possibilities. That's why you have a line. That's a classical three-level system where these three points, vertices, are orthogonal states, but also a convex mixture of them. You assign as a possible state space. Then we have a two-level system in a quantum theory based on real amplitudes, which is just a circle. And then you have a sphere in three dimensions, if you think about the Bloch vector representation of a qubit. And finally, you can think about the two-level system that is embedded maybe not in three dimensions, as we know for quantum mechanics, but maybe in some D dimension. So all these theories, and also many more, can be framed or can be understood as a special cases of a general probabilistic theory. Now, the joint state is given by for two parties, let's say shared by Alice and Bob, is in this framework given by a set of components of the vector state. The first is something which possesses Alice and completely describes Alice's particle. Then you have something which completely describes Bob's particle. And then you have a correlation tensor that accounts for all possible non-local measurements, but correlations. And finally, you might even have some global parameters for the people who are specialists in this, so you can have a theories that do not obey local tomography. So this is state of A, state of B, correlation tensors, and possible global parameters that you can read out only if you bring two particles together and perform a joint measurement. Now, transformations are those maps that, well, leave the state space invariant. And a non-trivial element that I need to assume in the GPT framework is the order of transformations. So I will say that M1 is before M2 and before Mn. If in this theory I can represent this as a composition of the maps one after the other. Now, the special attention should be paid to the local transformations because they will be used in Bell's theorem. Local transformations, GPTs, are those where I have a local operation on A and a B side. They transform the state in that way. And I just briefly comment what does it mean if they change the state in that very particular way. So you, first of all, we assume that they are reversible. They build up the group. And that's necessary in order to complete in a meaningful way the whole theory. But first of all, what's important is that there are no signaling. So Alice's state will be changed only by a local operation on Alice's side and not influenced by choice of the operation on Bob's side. We also assume that these two operations do not commute with each other. That means that there is only one correlation tensor. If they were not commuting, you would need to assume that there are two correlation tensors, one where Alice performs first the operation, then Bob, and the other one where the order is other way around. And given these assumptions, there is a very trivial statement that degree of violation of Bell's inequalities cannot be increased under local transformation. And this is just because when we say that the state is violated by Bell, is violating Bell's inequalities to a certain degree, what we do, we optimize over all possible local transformations. And therefore, under local operations, we cannot increase this, we cannot improve this optimization. And here is an example. An example is a quantum theory. A quantum theory, when we think about sharing, for example, a qubit in an entangled two-qubit state, then the correlation tensor is changed in that way. This is an orthogonal representation of the local operation on Alice and Bob's side. And when you look at the, for example, violation of Clausewitz-Horn-Shimoni-Holt inequality, this violation is actually given by the singular value in the singular value decomposition of a correlation tensor. And since these singular values are invariant under local transformations, or local unitaries, you cannot increase or improve violation of this inequality under local transformation. Okay, and then the last ingredient that I need in order to go on with the list of assumptions behind the Bell's theorem is the classical temporal order. So I will read the definition. A set of events is classically ordered if for each pair of events A and B, there exists a space-like surface and a lambda variable defined on it that determines the causal relation between A and B, such that either you have A is before B, B is before A, or they are causally neutral because they cannot influence each other. This is a more general definition of classical temporal order than we have in general relativity, first of all, because we can have distribution of this lambda with some probabilities. So we can have a stochastic way of defining. so we can average convex over different distribution of lambda, each lambda defining a specific order between events. And secondly, it could be also dynamical in a sense that if I pick up two events and then I have a space-like surface in the past, this will define the causal order between these two events. But let's say the last of those guys in this sequence can then influence by local operation, assuming that this local operation is not defined by lambda, like in a Bell's theorem. If he has a free choice to move matter around, he could then influence the causal order of the other guys in the future. So that's why we say that this classical order is not only stochastic, but also dynamical. Okay, in the general relativity, you usually have one space-like surface, which defines the causal order of all of them. You can relax this, even if you allowed some of the partners to change and influence of the causal order of the other partners in his own future. This is not an important, it's just a relaxation. You can take a more conservative situation, and this will be also fine. Okay, now we are coming to the assumptions.
That definition looks a little bit circular because it talks about space-like surface. So is the idea that this is some, at early times, there's some unique causal order and it's space-like with respect to that unique causal order?
Why do you think that it's needed to have a causal order?
Well, if you talk about space-like, that usually means a surface.
Yes.
Points of which are not in causal.
Yes, context. Yes. Yes, I understand not what you're saying. Or in all cases that we will consider, you will see that there will be a description of somebody far away who can even order this and make some time foliation. So all what is happening with a superposition of masses will be in some bounded space-time region. Okay.
So this other surface is before that?
Before that and afterwards.
And that, or,
yes.
Synchronization of clocks before those masses are considered to fluctuate, because otherwise there is no definition by how
the nobody gets you.
So I would say yes, the answer. But so here are the assumptions for Bell's theorem. So first of all, we will assume that the initial state shared by two observers does not violate Bell's inequality. Okay. Then the second assumption is about local transformation. Local transformations MA on system A and MB on system B cannot increase the amount of violation of Bell's inequalities of the state. And that even with some add on this, not even upon post-selection at space-like separated events. And then we have a classical causal order. The order of local transformation is classical, is predefined by assumption. And finally, we have one assumption that is always common for Bell's theorem, that measurement choices are independent of the rest of the experiment. Okay, so we have a local state. It doesn't violate Bell's inequalities. Then we perform local transformation, which cannot make this state violate Bell's inequalities. We have a definite causal order and a free choice. And the result is that the final state will also not violate Bell's inequalities because it obeys all, in the theory that obeys all four possible four assumptions. So it's easy to prove that under these assumptions, you cannot violate Bell's inequalities. Namely, there is a no-go theorem, no state, set of transformation, and measurements which obey these assumptions can result in a violation of Bell's inequalities. So here is the proof. Schematically, there is some distribution of matter and some lambda associated to this. And we assume that at the beginning, we have a two-party state, which is a local set, a local state, sorry, and that means that the probability if I would perform at that stage a measurement on these two particles will be decomposable in a locally causal way as in a Bell's theorem. You see that this probability doesn't depend on y's and this not on x. Now, if I have a definite causal order, then I can think about applying local operations in steps. So first, I apply the local operations MA1 and MA2 on this, and then afterwards, a new pair of local operations, MB1 and MB2. That means that if I apply this sequence of measurements, then I will again have a probability distribution that can be decomposed in a locally causal way, where this state here that is now shared is obtained by a sequence of first pair of local operations and then second pair of local operations. And by definitions, we said the local operations cannot increase the violation of Bell's inequalities. Therefore, the final state cannot do it either. Now, here is a way how we can do it with quantum physics, and it involves gravitational quantum switch that I introduced before. So here, I will have a superposition of mass configuration, and there is a color code that if the mass is on the left-hand side, it's orange color code, then the order of events or unitaries that are applied on this particle is the orange one. So what you have here left and what you have here right is a gravitational switch that I introduced before. So I have so-called, you can think about the entangled gravitational switch. So you have here one gravitational switch and here one gravitational switch. Okay, so what do you have? You have a mass configuration at the beginning, and you have a system that is in product states, so it cannot violate Bell's inequalities. So we satisfy the first assumption for the Bell's theorem. And then what we have here that this system goes, and if we have a configuration orange one, then A1 is before B1, but if the configuration is blue one, the order of unity is the other way around, and this is also the same for the second particle. Okay, now, if we would just trace out the state of the mass, we will just have a classical mixture of these different causal orders, and that will be non-interesting. You need to overlap the mass, and basically in that way, erase the information which of the two has happened. So if you do so, and okay, before you do that, it's just before the final measurement has been performed, you still have that, what I said. So you have for one configuration, one order of unitaries on both sides, and for the other configuration, the opposite order of unitaries. Now, if at the D we measure in a basis which is complementary to the configuration basis, so this plus minus superposition of these two, bringing the mass on the beam splitter, if you want, and post-selecting one or the other result, what you are remained with is something which is, if you want to say, it's a superposition of unitaries applied on the product state with plus and minus depending on which result you obtain by measuring the mass. Now, you can pick up these unitaries such that they take this form in which the final state here and here shared before I enter the C laboratories is a maximal entangled state. And obviously, if you have a maximal entangled state, you can perform some local operations as in a usual Clausewitz-Horn-Shimonic Hall test in order to get the violation even the maximal one, or minus plus 2 square root of 2. Okay, so we have a violation. We have a local operations. We have a local state. So if we believe that we satisfy all possible assumptions, the only remaining one is that you don't have a definite temporal order. Locally, the temporal order is not definite. And this is now proven in a theory-independent way, in a sense that no theory from the general probabilistic framework that satisfies the four assumptions can lead to the violation. Therefore, the violation implies that one of those four assumptions is not met. And if you're sure that you keep track of local operations and local states, it should be that the order of operations is not well defined before we perform the experiment. Now, this is, of course, a Gedanken experiment, and there is no hope to do it in a real experiment, but it's a matter of principle. And it's also a matter of whether you keep track of all degrees of freedom and you're sure that there is no leakage of information, that in principle you can perform such an experiment. And here's a little bit more realistic representation of that. Again, the color code is the same. This is the two parties in one switch, and this is the two parties in another switch. And basically, the idea is to direct the systems into Alice's laboratory, Bob's laboratory, Alice's laboratory, and then Bob's again. But it's important to keep track of the local time. So if you have an orange configuration, then the first enters of the photon into Alice's laboratory is the one when you perform the operation, and the second one will be just closed laboratory. It's just a mirror that will bounce back the photons. And if this is a blue configuration, it will be the other way around. This is the moment when you perform the operation, and the moment before that will be when the photons come to the laboratory and just bounces back. Okay, this is a slightly more realistic one. There is one thing that I didn't mention, but you have to think about that, is that there is nothing in the moment when you apply operation that will distinguish this situation. Just because you define the event as performance of this operation at a very specific proper time moment, tau star. But if you keep and have these clocks in your laboratories, they will keep run if you keep the mass next to laboratories, keep rank on the different rate, and eventually they will be still entangled with a mass configuration. That means that you have to erase this information. One way to erase this information is, well, to swap the masses and then to have a symmetric setup such that if one of the clocks were taking a different rate than the other one, the rates will be swapped by swapping the masses. And therefore, here at this moment, you will erase any information that could possibly be stored in the local clocks. Now, if you look at some numbers, these are quite discouraging. You can all either choose to wait for 100 years, but maybe if you want to have a small number here, 10 hours, then you put some numbers, 0.9 microgram, then you have distances about 0.1 nanometer or femtometer, then, this is a tremendous density of matter you require, more than for the neutron stars. But again, the question is about matter of principle, not that we are really proposing a concrete experiment, but I can also comment later on about that. The interesting thing is, if you compare it with some numbers that are coming from collapse models, and this is the so-called Dioschi-Penrose time that was also introduced by Penrose for the idea that you should not have large superpositional masses because the space-time will not be well-defined. I mean, roughly speaking, I tried right now to recapitulate his motivation. And then there is a delta, which is a free parameter in theory. It's not fixed, but there are different papers that propose some numbers. Now, there are some papers suggesting that this should be 10 to the minus 7 meters, should be, sorry. And then if you compute, it's a basically the characteristic length after which you should start to decohere. It's interesting that although the numbers are unfeasible, you can always choose the parameters in experiment in such a way that the time that is needed to complete the experiment, even deleting this information in the clock, is shorter than the Dirichlet-Penrose time. And therefore, you can, at least in principle, prove that the temporal order is not definite before the collapse takes place. And the collapse was introduced in the first place, actually, with some motivation not to have these situations that we can disprove in the Bell's theorem. We used to disprove the Bell's theorem. And then if you take a shorter length, so these are meters, I'm sorry, you still can pick up the time of the experiment to be shorter than the Dirichlet-Penrose time. Okay, now I have a more general statement, and this is related also to Raphael's question. Obviously, we perform this calculation using quantum theory, and what we have used is actually a certain time foliation in which we then define the states at every instant in our experiment. And that was the time foliation of somebody who is far away and with respect to the coordinate time or local time of a very distant observer. So certainly there is certain sense of the global temporal order of the whole state. Okay, but the thing is that, and furthermore, this person, and this is important, will, looking at the application when the two unitaries are applied, for example, unitary of Alice in the orange configuration and unitary of Alice in the blue configuration, that these two times will be different times according to a coordinate time. So if you would given a coordinate of this event, Alice applies unitary UA, you will give two coordinate times, coordinates and coordinate times, T0 and T1. However, and I think this is an interesting twist here, is that local observer will find these two times identical according to the local time, because the proper time is a combination of the coordinate time and the G0 tensor component, and then you can have, well, two possible solutions that will give the same proper time. So according to the local observer, he will experience this as a single event, whereas the distant observer will experience this, the coordinate of this time as a two events. Or maybe he will say this is a two events, or this is depend now how we define the event, whether we say that this is a coordinate, time coordinate of the event, or we really specify the event with a space-time point at the manifold. So here is attempt to use this operational way that it's defined by operation, and from the local point of view, the core time coordinate of this local operation is tau star in both of these amplitudes, whereas for distant observer, he has this kind of ambiguity of assigning the two coordinates time T0 and T1. Okay, so here's the summary, and then I go just two slides for the outlook, if it's still fine with you. The summary, well, given all other assumptions were fulfilled, the experiment would demonstrate incompatibility of quantum mechanics with a local classical temporal order. Local classical mean definite, predefined, temporal ordered, and obviously the resource for this was a non-classical space-time. Now, for every Dirichlet-Penrose collapse time, one can find the mass and relative distances such that the duration of the time particle is shorter than the collapse time. Notion of event is defined through the local operation, not as a point in the space-time manifold. And although we don't have no local classical temporal order, yet there is a global time evolution of the quantum state. And the natural question is whether one can go even beyond that. Because there is this one picture which everything happens one after the other, although locally we can exclude, or we have a no-go theorem for the all local predefined temporal order. And I will have two ideas, which I will now say only something about one of them. And this has to do something with the causal inequalities. It's just two slides, which is somewhat condensed. Maybe some of you are more familiar with this. I'll try to explain this. So the idea of the causal inequalities is really to disprove, in a sense, any attempt to explain measurement data in a causal manner. So first I introduce this just for two observers. It's something which is completely device independent. It's just in terms of probabilities. And the idea is that the causal influence are defined by the signaling. So here is something which we'll call a causal correlations. The causal correlations, this probability distribution, can be decomposed in a convex mixture of a probability where A is before B and probability that B is before A. The probability that P is before B means that A can signal to B, but not the other way around. So there is no signaling from B to A. Therefore, if I sum up over local results of Alice to get the Bob's marginal can depend on Alice's input and, of course, of his input. But if I do it the other way around and sum up over Bob's results to get the marginal Alice side, Alice probability depends only on her setting and not the setting of the partner. So we will say that causal probabilities is a one in which I can find that one observer is before the other in that sense, or we have a convex mixture and we don't know which of the two situations happen. Now you can extend this to many observers, in which you basically assume a sum over all possible different orders of the observers in space-time diagram, where one is before the other, and so on. So this is a general definitions where you can permute the observers, but there is always a definite order. Now, causal correlations satisfy causal inequalities, and I don't introduce these causal inequalities, but you can introduce them and show that all these probabilities satisfy these constraints. Now, you see that this approach is even somehow stronger notion of causality than the Bell's theorem, because in the Bell's theorem, although it was defined in terms of probabilities, there was one non-trivial assumption, and that was this composition of operations. I had to explain this in terms of general probabilistic theories, in which I could introduce local operations and composition, sequence of local operations. Here, I have nothing from the theory. It's purely in terms of probabilities. And now, these causal correlations satisfy causal inequalities, but unfortunately, quantum switch satisfies all causal inequalities. You can prove that any probability you can obtain from gravitational switch will satisfy this. It is causal, it has a model, causal model, and satisfy all causal inequalities. So there is no way to do it by violating causal inequalities. And furthermore, we don't know of any process in nature that would violate them. The process that we know how to prepare in laboratory. But there is a formalism, and that's some of you are maybe familiar with that. That's a formalism of process matrices which do violate causal inequalities. And this is a part of the speculation. The idea is that those processes can never be understood in any causal manner. It's a trivial thing because it violates causal inequalities. So that's maybe the way how we can go beyond this, what I call like a definite global causal order. There is no way to understand in any causal manner. And this is the last slide. the quantum circuit is an abstraction of causal processes in quantum mechanics, where you have some preparation and then sequence of some operations and some gates that, well, happens in certain time. These process matrices cannot be described in this way. So that's why everything what connects local operation is this E shape, where maybe you know that M1 is before M2 and M3, but then you don't know any, and there is no way to find out which of these two operations is the first. And formally, the process matrix formalism tells you that probabilities in this formalism are obtained in a way that, according to the trace rule, so it resembles quantum mechanics, reduced to quantum mechanics in all causal, definite causal situation, where you have here a local quantum transformation, complete positive maps. These are these gray shadowed regions. And then you have a process matrix. It's a dual of that. It defines these probabilities as a scalar product. And the only restriction on these process matrices is that they give rise to well-defined probabilities, probabilities that are between 0 and 1. And when you sum up over all possible results, A1, A2, and so on, they are normalized. In this framework, you can show that there are process matrices that would violate causal inequalities that I introduced in the previous slide. Unfortunately, we don't know how to, even if we know to write down this process matrices, we don't know whether they can be realized in nature. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Let's start with student questions.
I wanted to clarify about the role of the gravitational switch in the temporal order Bell theorem case, because are you looking at it operationally, or is it part of the causal order? Because the reason I'm asking this is because in Bell's theorem, you can create an entangled state and share this. But here it's like Alice and Bob have no control over if there's a quantum switch, this gravitational quantum switch happening in the background or not.
Alice and Bob not, but there is maybe somebody who is far away who can send a mass left and right, and he can control the order of them by putting the mass left and right. If you are more familiar with the optical version of switch, that would be the path maybe going left. I mean, usually you have this measurement station. And then the path could be one or the other. So you can have maybe photon when you apply this operations on a polarization, but the path would be the control. Here, it's not that you actively send something left to right, but rather mass. That would be the control of the causal order.
Mentioned early on that one of your assumptions was that a semi-classical limit would reproduce precisely predictions of general relativity. But you also were describing these quantum states as something like coherent states, so they have some variance.
Yes.
Couldn't that lead to sort of not general relativistic predictions, but a kind of noisier version? And I was just wondering if that could influence the conclusions. Like, is that a way out? Rather than give up on there being definite temporal order, could you say, well, maybe that assumption was wrong, that this semi-classical limit is reproducing the predictions of general relativity?
I don't think so, because the difference in what clocks show on Alice and Bob's side through this time dilation are much larger, assumed to be much larger, than any possible fluctuations in each of them. So I don't think this is a crucial thing. This assumption is rather there to be able to compute anything, namely, if it is a semi-classical state, to be able to compute what the quantum, what the time dilation would be. But what I do think is that even in this situation, and that's maybe interesting for a quantum gravity community, is that even that what we will call as a classical light state, because it has an uncertainty already related, a coherent state, it already would fluctuate metric, and maybe even with that you will be able to show well, some indefiniteness in the causal order due to the quantum nature of the each of these mass configuration. But here we take really the Schrödinger-Cat states without looking at any uncertainties of any of these two states in the superposition.
Yeah, I just make a comment and then a question. So I think it's very interesting because it really is, in some sense, quantum gravity, although it's limited to kind of DC fields. You don't see the propagating degrees of freedom. But this will tell us nothing about gravitons, whether they exist or not. But if you really did perform this experiment, it would rule out something that people have called semi-classical gravity, which no one really believes in anymore, unfortunately. But I think people like Rosenfeld did actually propose that gravity should remain classical and only matter fields, so to speak, should be quantized. Now, that's not in itself a dead idea, although no one that I know actually pursues it. But the particular form in which I think it was proposed is dead, and that you should have Einstein's equation with, on the left-hand side, the Einstein tensor classical, and on the right-hand side, the expectation value of the stress energy tensor in the given quantum state. And if you had that, then you would have both Alice and Bob's clocks slowing at half the amount that would be predicted if the mass was there. And so they wouldn't, the temporal order wouldn't be disturbed. And you could see from that why no one really believes it, because it says that if you had a superposition of a mass here and a mass here, that you would have a gravitational field that pointed of half the strength towards this mass and half the strength towards this mass. But it's not actually, as far as I know, experimentally ruled out. I mean, Don Page did an experiment, so-called experiment, that he claimed to rule it out, but it wouldn't, no matter what your attitude towards quantum mechanics was, everyone would have expected the answer that he got, which was he picked up the mass and put it here, or picked it. And it turned out that the gravitational field was completely where he put it and not half there, half in the other. But this really would, if it were performed, I think, exclude that semi-classical gravity.
I guess even a simpler experiment will do it. I mean, if you have the superposition here and here, and you have a pro particle going, it will go through in a semi-classical gravity.
Yes.
But in the other one, you will get entanglement here. And again, by bringing these two masses on beam split, you will see that there is a coherence between these two things. I guess, I mean, this would also do, but maybe there is even an easier way.
Experimentally, you think.
Yeah. But I agree the results will be completely, I mean, will be different. You will not have a violation without.
And the question is, I wonder if there's a reason why this is not violating. I do not know what these causal inequalities are. But we could probably make another model of the experiment that would have the same practical effect, where instead of putting a mass, you send some sand that gets into the clock and slows its works down. And it's a superposition of sending the sand here or sending the sand here. Then no gravity is involved, but you have the same practical effect that the clock, you have superposition of a slow clock here and a fast clock here, or a slow clock here and a fast clock here. And then that's kind of self-evident, that kind of thing, because it fits into the non-relativistic quantum framework, shouldn't be violating any causal blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure if that's a fair statement or not.
So, first of all, there is a different levels of device independence of these proofs, let's say. So one is just you assume quantum mechanics, and then you can prove that this switch is not a convex mixture of channels and states, for example. The channel is something where you sequence perform operations. State is something which they share. This thing, quantum switch, is neither channel nor state, not a convex mixture of that. That's one step. Then there is a Bell's theorem, where you a little bit go towards theory-independent proofs, because it's in terms of probabilities, but you assume that you have a notion of composition, of order of operations. So that's why I had to introduce general probabilistic theories, a little bit of framework of that. I need some theory-dependent notions, very weak, but still. And then there is causal inequalities that you can introduce without any reference to any theories, just purely probabilistic thing. So the first two you can violate, the last one you cannot. And I'm not sure why. I have an impression that as long as you will have one reference frame in which you can have this time foliation, that's the reference frame in which you can make the whole model. And that's why you cannot violate causal inequality. There is no proof for that, I'm saying. That's my impression.
But that's consistent with what I was suggesting, because in the SAN model, there is one just ordinary Galilean reference frame in which you can describe the whole experiment.
Okay, and then the question is why, I guess you refer also, why then you do this gravitational switch if you can do it with the SAN? Or is this? No.
Ah, okay. I think it's very.
Okay, thank you.
I don't think that model will, for example, exclude the semi-classical gravity theory.
And only maybe just to complete this, so my only impression from this process matrices is when so some of them involve innocent time-like curves, innocent. Because you cannot send information back to your own past, so you cannot have a grandfather paradox. But they cannot be written in this linear time. So if you write, there should be some curves. That's one way how you can violate those. And there is another, and these are even, you can find that it's a Lugano group. They found pure reversible processes that can violate causal inequalities, but require some innocent time-like curves. The other one is that what we found at the first paper is something which cannot be purified. It's a mixed process. Again, you cannot write it in a linear time. So this suggests that as soon as as you have a linear time and you can write this as a circuit, then you will not be able to write causal inequalities.
So you have here, there is this presumption of some sort of like a Cauchy surface background or like global hyperbolicity or so on. And you know, I think that it actually,
speak louder.
Okay. So like there is this presumption of global hyperbolicity, like put like somehow to make this everything sound as definition, but somehow it seems that it's having this external observer seems to be like very much irrelevant to the like how the problem kind of could be intentionally defined. And I think that if one follows this idea of Ruland that like measurement systems should be actually massive and assigns basically like sort of basic startup like zero mass to both like A and B, and then it could be like a source for some like basically time foliation, like in the sense like if we will assume that there is like non-fluctuating mass on both parties or any parties in like a multi-user situation, there will be like this default Cauchy surface box around which the causal perturbation of like fluctuation over the top of this mass could be considered. So like I think that like one can internalize by assuming massiveness of particular users, like one can remove the necessity of externalization of the global reference frame. But then there would be a question how to define to make it consistent with GR. And there is this problem of quasi-local mass. which like how to localize the massiveness while remaining like the GR works. And like here, I don't have a suggestion how to do it. But I think that assuming massiveness of the users basically is, and that there is some permanent classical mass that we, for our purposes or for all practical purposes, you know, we keep it as it is, should get rid of like the third party intake.
Perspective.
Yeah.
I have only one comment. I mean, I have to learn more about that, what you're saying, that we relax this. I mean, if you think about, let's say, Cauchy surface, what we assume here, that there is maybe something in the causal past of these two that defines the causal order between these. This is a distribution of matter in the causal past. But then we say, okay, maybe there is a free parameter here, the setting, let's say, which does not depend on lambda. And I can then use this free parameter to define the causal order of the next one. So it's not that the Cauchy surface necessarily need to fix the causal order of all pairs. It could be also the free parameter, and still the theorem will go through. So it's kind of relaxation of that.
Absolutely.
Sorry, excuse me. I just want to announce that the conference is commencing upstairs.
That's fine.
You are something.
Okay, thank you.
Trivial synchronization.
Well, before we wrap up, I had one more question.
Yes, sure.
The numbers you gave for, you know, like a microgram separated by a nanometer, is that based on, for example, the best kinds of interference experiments we can do, like the
position
of buckyball experiments, that sort of
thing? No, it's far away from it. It's just, no, it was, it, the idea, okay, you have to keep this coherence for a long time, so let's take the shortest you can think of. But then I mean, you can choose where to put the non-feasibility of this experiment, and this is here now put in the density of the matter, but you can put also on the duration of the experiment.
All right, here's my question. Take the other experiment you described for Raphael.
This one, yeah.
Take the state-of-the-art best buckyball type.
I don't know about, but this is...
As your mass?
Yeah.
So the buckyball type experiment separates some amount of mass, or maybe cantilever
experiment. Cantilever is more prone.
Okay. So take cantilever. That'll create a difference in gravitational in gravitational field. How does it compare to the sensitivity of LIGO?
Oh, my God.
The gravitational waves are...
Yes.
So it's conceivable that it might be...
I don't propose
an experiment to rule out these
semi-classical ones. I think this is the easiest one which I know. But I mean, you basically can have, I mean, there is a stupid way to do it. You put here a detector, and if you detect something, it's not the other way around. but I don't know how convincing this will be.
Okay, well, thanks, Czeslaw, again. There's snacks downstairs.